Welcome to the Marshall Pruitt Podcast. This episode we have my friend Mark Blundell. This interview goes back a year or two, might even be three. Spoke about his famous, infamous, record-setting, mind-blowing, shattering of everything pole position run at the 1990 24 Hours of Le Mans in his factory Nissan prototype. This legendary run, not too far from what we experienced in 1986 with Gerhard Berger in the Benetton BMW F1 car at Monza, where the wastegate stuck and refused to blow off excess turbo boost, where Berger had something in the 1400 horsepower plus range. Blundell in his twin turbo V8 Nissan had over 1,000 for sure. And that was just part of the craziness that allowed the Briton to not only set pole position, but gap the rest of the field by, let's just say, 6 seconds. We've never seen anything like this before, and it was a lark. It was a complete lark. Wasn't supposed to happen like that. Even better, this pole position was done not on qualifying tires. And had he known that extra turbo boost was available and the power was going to absolutely skyrocket, he says that there was more time left in the car, believes he could have been on pole by almost 9 seconds. Just nuts. So, had a great conversation with Mark. Big, big fan of his, have been forever. Really talented guy, obviously. Huge in IndyCar, winning races there. Was a big talent in Formula One. Rarely ever had machinery deserving of his talent, but nonetheless, someone who was a real all-rounder. And of the many things he accomplished in his career, this wild, hair-raising lap at Le Mans, certainly one that stands out, I think, possibly above all. So this is an interview, again, from a couple years ago, with him just recounting what it was like going through this. So thanks to him for spending some time to bring us inside this nutty occurrence. Best way to get more of the Marshall Pruitt Podcast, all the latest episodes, join our new Marshall Pruitt Podcast page on Facebook. If you're a fan of iTunes, you can subscribe there as well. So, off we go with Mark Blundell in his 1990 qualifying run at the 24 Hours of Le Mans.
The Nissan one is an interesting one, Marshall, because you probably know that we were never supposed to do that lap.
Yeah.
And the build-up during that week was one of sort of tension and frustration. And it started even at the beginning of the week when I and the other lead driver there, a guy called Julian Bailey, had to make a decision on who was going to qualify the car and who was going to start the race. So we tossed a coin on that one, and I won the toss, and I chose to do the qualifying with the knowledge that we had this hand grenade of an engine sitting in the back of one of the cars that was going to be used for that special lap, not knowing that, unfortunately, it was going to be incredibly temperamental and wasn't running properly every time we went out. And come the end of the qualifying sort of practice runs, we had this one little twilight zone that existed, and the sweet spot of Le Mans qualifying when you come to dusk, when you've got that moisture in the air and you've still got track temperature and a degree of daylight. And we went out there for the last run that was achievable. And basically, we had to make a call on going out on race tyres because we had no knowledge and no experience of qualifying tyres. So to this day, I still believe that that car was capable of doing a quicker lap than what we achieved.
Really?
If we'd have had a level of grip that, yeah, for sure, because the lap was done on race tyres. We never got the car even tuned in. It was just a gut reaction, instinctive lap. And every corner that came at us was one of no background and reference because, you know, it was all fresh. It was a totally reactive, series of corners put together.
Sure.
The warm-up lap, we started to get, you know, a little bit of a feel for what was going on, but halfway around the lap, the guys from pit lane requested that basically I abort the lap and pull the car in the pits because the engine was over boosting, which had been one of the major problems we had had during that week. Being a little bit young and naive at the time, because back then I think I was only about 23 years old.
Yeah.
Still quite young for a factory driver. And having a hell of a week of frustration because, you know, I knew that if I could get myself into that car, there was, you know, a big possibility of doing something special. So I did the old school thing, really. I kind of disconnected the radio and thought, to hell with it. If they can't hear me and I can't hear them, then, you know, let's go and see what this baby's got. And that's really what happened. And, you know, I started the lap coming off of the last chicane to get onto the start-finish line. And when I hit the throttle in anger, that was the first time we'd ever got full throttle. To this day, I still remember the car spinning its wheels in fourth gear before I got to the Dunlop chicane. And going through the Dunlop chicane, you've probably seen on the video, but if you watch the YouTube video from in-car, it's a tremendous amount of opposite lock-on. And, you know, it was one of those laps which was purely from a driving perspective, one of the most exhilarating laps because it was going into the unknown. The car was not the best handling car in the world, but at the same time we had a rocket, you know, propelling us, and I think we were somewhere in the region of 1,080 horsepower at that point. You know, we ran with the carbon brakes because that was you know, also new era kind of stuff back then in Group C.
Yeah.
And we topped out 238 miles an hour with the chicanes in on the Mulsanne. So still some pretty sensational speeds. And I do believe that there was some lap time left in it on even those tyres, because if I'd have known what the car would do and didn't do, we still caught a little bit of traffic at the Porsche curves. But as I say, with some knowledge, a little bit softer tyre, I'm pretty sure that there was a good 2 or 3 seconds left in that thing. And to still turn the lap in and be 6 seconds clear of everybody else was very special. And, you know, it's one of those laps that will stick with me for a long time, that's for sure.
If there's a little context, and I don't want to say it's been missing from the narrative, but you with your F3000 experience, I know that Formula One obviously became your reality the year after in terms of that being, you know, a full-time career move, but this wasn't some kid who'd only farted around in Formula 3 cars and, you know, knew what 200 horsepower felt like. I mean, you've coming into Le Mans, maybe that lap, certainly the car was a beast and an unexpected beast, but it also wasn't as if you were caught, you know, out of your comfort zone or ability. I guess that's maybe the one thing that's always stood out in the video is, you know, your hands are moving the entire time trying to hold on to the thing, but, you know, you're at a stage in your career where, you know, really fast, scary cars is kind of what you're making your name with.
Yeah, I mean, you know, again, being candid with you, I think I come from a, you know, back then, if you look at that 89-90 back-to-back seasons, I was doing F3000, Group C, and Formula One testing with Williams. So I was kind of like, you know, back in the old AJ Foyt days where you got in and drove anything and everything, and back in the Jim Clark, Graham Hill days in Europe. You know, and for me, I still feel that that's a great asset because, you know, when you get that variety of cars and different power bands, different handling, different understandings of, you know, what the engineering guys are doing, it gave you a great depth and a great tool cover to work from. So, you know, it didn't faze me with the car. In fact, I relished it. Probably from a driver perspective, I was always a little bit on the bigger side and in terms of my frame. And had a little bit more strength than some of the guys, so I think it probably also stood me in good stead because, you know, that was a 700 kilo plus car with a lot of grip, and it took a lot of hanging on to. I mean, yeah. You know, we weren't talking about power steering back in those days. So, you know, it was a serious piece of kit, as I would call it. And, you know, yeah, it was something that, you know, you had to suck up and go with it, but at the same time, you know, as I say, it was an incredible sensation. And you know, by the way, I still got my backside kicked when I got back to pit lane. So as much as there was happy faces and smiling ones, there was some very serious and big frowns on some Japanese bosses there as well.
You know, I've always, and tell me if you agree, but in Formula One, there's one legendary event, I guess in F1, with Berger, Monza, 86, BMW turbo, wastegate sticking open, and, you know, it seems like every year the horsepower figure increases. It was 9 million horsepower for one lap, but, you know, they yeah. You know, they've, more than enough people have said it was probably something in the 1400 range before everything ventilated itself. Do you have an appreciation that, at least in the world of sports cars, you essentially have that narrative of the turbo motor gone wild for, you know, that magical one lap?
Yeah, I think that probably is true. I think we've, you know, I think I'm, you know, if there was a Le Mans folklore legend there, I think that probably exists there with that lap. And also because it kind of set the lap record as well at the same time around the place. You know, definitely for a turbo car back in that era. I think I'm still the youngest guy ever to sit on pole as well. I'd have to check that, but I think, you know, so there was loads of things that went along with it, but, you know, the main storyline was that turbo engine and the excessive power and the wastegate sticking open.
1990 has been a focal point for many years, but curious, just from a power and speed standpoint, where your the Peugeot 905 Evo stood in 1992 among the you know, rocket fast cars you've driven at Le Mans, but just curious where that beast sits in your memory of holy crap type speed.
Well, you know, yeah, you know what? They're a very different animal, and I say that in that the Nissan was more of a you know, brute force and ignorance. The Peugeot was a much more refined vehicle, and everything about it was you know, very much in harmony, from the aerodynamics of the car to the tractable engine. You know, the whole package was very well engineered, and as such, you know, the way in which you drove it was a lot different as well. But you know, that again was just, as those years rolled on, the technology started to develop and come through the system. And then even from 92, when I got back into, you know, a little LMP2 car, and we made some noises, you know, back in the early 2000s of MG, you were very much aerodynamically led. And then stepping away from there and going back into 2003 with the Bentley, where unfortunately we lost out on the win again through a couple of little small battery terminals, you know, a few dollars of equipment that cost us, but we still finished second. And I have to say, you know, that as a racing car was one of the most complete cars I've ever driven, career-wise, and you know, something very special as well. And, you know, going into Indianapolis corner, lap after lap after lap in that Bentley, is something that will stick in my mind to the day I die.
And that was Mark Blundell on that famous 1990 qualifying run at the 24 Hours of Le Mans, and also some insider thoughts on some of his other favorite prototypes that he raced at the Great, Great Endurance event. Again, you can get more Marshall Pruitt podcasts on our Facebook page. You can also subscribe on iTunes. As always, I'm Marshall Pruitt. Thanks for listening.